We talk a lot in Canada about being a multicultural society, a place where diverse people are able to live their lives the way they want, celebrate what and how they want, without being forced into an American-style melting pot. But are we really a multicultural society the way we envision it? My guest today said something during our interview that really made me stop and think. His suggestion is that while Canada is certainly a multi-ethnic country, we're failing at this multicultural idea. I hadn't thought about it this way before, but I do now think he's right, and perhaps you'll think so too by the end of today's episode. My name is Eric Bowman. I'm the communications person at the Canadian Psychological Association, and this is Mindful. We've talked on this podcast about microaggressions and unconscious bias when it comes to everyday racism in the workplace or within organizations or even within committed loving relationships. One of the facets of this that we haven't really touched on, however, is cultural aggression. I'm making up that word, but the idea that all of our federal holidays come from a place of white Christian colonial dominance, that our systems and structures in Canada come from that same place, and that true multiculturalism becomes impossible as a result. My guest today has a new book out called Developing Anti-Racist Cultural Competence. And if you, like me, want to read it right away, there is a link in the show notes. Let's meet today's guests.
My name is Dr. Raymond Abdrahman. I'm a clinical and consulting psychologist. My focus has been on clinically on anxiety and trauma and cross-cultural work, and my consulting work on applying all of that to organizations. And I work on diversity, equity, inclusion, and leadership.
And you're coming out with a book called Developing Anti-Racist Cultural Competence, which I'm very interested in, just because I think the cultural piece is something we miss in that a lot. That, you know, we look at people as monolithic groups and cultures, and we sort of don't really dig into the actual cultural relevance of a lot of this. So I'm hoping you can tell me a little bit about what this book's going to be about and what we're going to be learning from reading it.
Yeah, when I sought up to do this work, first and foremost, I never thought I'd write a book. I did a lot of ranting. and I was like, well,
I've seen your TED Talk.
Yeah, thanks. So when I've been doing this work, the frustrating part is people move to anti-racist or cross-cultural competence and not recognizing the two have to overlap in order to do an effective job when we're working with people. And then also, more importantly, a lot of cross-cultural work, a lot of people approach it kind of like you're taking a walk through the zoo, where you're learning about other people, not recognizing your role in a human interaction, especially when you've got power and privilege in a professional relationship with somebody. And so this book is really less about learning about the other and more about learning about yourself in a cross-cultural interaction, and how, if you're not aware of what's happening in cross-cultural circumstances, you can actually end up harming somebody. And so in order to be culturally competent, one also needs to be anti-racist. And a lot of the work that's done cross-culturally can be very patronizing if it's not done in an anti-racist way.
Right. And I think that's something we've talked about a lot, right? This idea that equity, diversity, and inclusion has to be a lot more than just ticking the boxes and hiring somebody from a different culture, from a different race, and having, you know, that kind of representation. You also have to create a place where those people feel welcome, where there's, you know, a sort of workplace culture or, you know, an organizational culture that really embraces the diversity that you're seeking to achieve.
Absolutely. And for me, it's about learning to acknowledge what our community looks like now. You know, I referenced several what looked like really brilliant models of cross-cultural competence, and they are all pretty much focused on international models. You know, and so when we think cross-culturally, most of us are thinking internationally. And we don't recognize that our community here is actually very diverse. You know, we live in a country that's technically supposed to be multicultural. And I would say we're more unicultural and multi-ethnic. But we have to move towards what that actually means to be an inclusive multicultural community. And so this book really approaches things, I think, from the perspective of redefining what community means here in Canada or in North America. What does that look like? And we don't recognize, and I think because of concepts like white supremacy, where one monolithic culture takes over, everybody's meant to assimilate into that. We don't pay attention to the numerous rich cultures and communities that make up a broad community. And I think we lose out on that. So that's where I come from this perspective of cultural competence.
Like I said, I watched your TED talk. I thought that there was something really interesting in there, a great analogy, I guess, which is this idea that you mentioned of having somebody come to your house for dinner who's vegetarian, someone in your family. Yeah. And that specifically resonated with me because this is something that we do every Thanksgiving, every Christmas, right? We have family members who are vegan, and creating a meal for people who, you know, to include those people as well as everybody else, takes a lot more work. It's, you know, and frankly, right now I have somebody living in my house who is vegan, and trying to meal plan is a little bit more difficult. My wife's allergic to just about everything that vegans eat. So I'm making two suppers every night, that kind of thing, right? But this idea that, right, that the monolithic culture model that we live in says, oh, you're coming to my house, you're going to eat what I serve you, regardless of what your personal beliefs are, and so on. And that's something that we sort of have to move past, right? That it's okay. Yeah. It might take a tiny bit more work, but it's not that difficult to include people of different stripes, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly it. And I love food in general. I'm a bit of a foodie, but it's a really good metaphor because, I mean, if you really think about what makes good food, it really is, you know, we have this vague concept of love, is that when we pay attention to the food that we make, you know, a simple meal can have a very profound impact. Food is the way, food is a part of culture, but it's not all of it, but it is the perfect metaphor. You know, how inviting are we? You know, how inclusive are we? And who do we consider to be living and worthy of that food? And I think when we just look from eating from a perspective of what we eat, I mean, I think that's a very selfish perspective and not something we would really want to project as an identity. And yet we do that every day when it comes to culture.
Your book is essentially a how-to, I believe. Going back to your TED talk just for a moment, right? You describe a moment where you're on a plane and there's a lady who asks you the question that bothers everybody, which is, where are you from? And so on. And then you have really a teaching moment where she realizes that's not an appropriate question. She asks you why, you explain it to her. Is that sort of the explanation we're getting in this book? Is it, okay, here's why that's an inappropriate question, and here's how we can do that better? Or is it, you know, is that basically where it's coming from?
It is exactly where that's coming from. And it goes into far more depth, right? It goes into the understanding of what it feels like to be somebody who comes from a marginalized community. You know, the impact of that on ethnic and cultural identity development, and even explaining why, if you're hiring a person of color, why that alone does not necessarily suggest you're being culturally competent or addressing equity and inclusion, because even people of color don't necessarily always understand what that means. You know, if you are drinking the Kool-Aid, you're the one, even if you're a person of color, you'll be promoting white supremacy. And actually, you know, I've done some research. We've collected data on bias, and it confirms that. We've got this massive body of data thanks to this tool I've developed called the Bias Outside the Box test, the BOB tool. And it goes to show that even people who are marginalized carry the same patterns of biases as people who are not marginalized. And it goes to show the presence and the prevalence and the impact of white supremacy can have on the thinking and the psychology of all of us. So this book goes into that depth. It certainly deconstructs what seems like a simple concept, you know, don't put up burning crosses, to understanding the burning cross in our mind.
Yes, the burning cross is the very obvious, blatant, overt racism that we sort of picture. And a lot, I think for a lot of us, we say, oh, we don't see that anymore, therefore we've solved the problem. But the problem persists. It's just a little bit more hidden. There's a little more plausible deniability for it and that sort of thing, right? And you mentioned this, the bias test that you've created. I did that bias test and I was very surprised at some of the results. There's one guy in the photo who's wearing all Oakland Raiders gear. And I just associate that with loving rap music because of NWA in the 90s. You know, Ice Cube, even after he left the band or after he left the group, was talking about, you know, stop, you know, wearing Raiders gear because Al Davis never paid us, you know. And so I assumed that that guy was a rap fan, but I was wrong, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And it goes to show that we make judgments about people all of the time. And they're not always, they're not about us being intentionally racist, but I do think that we carry with us, you know, like we inherit certain beliefs, not just from our families, but our cultures. And I mean, that's where that systemic racism comes in. You know, if certain ideologies are propagated and they're not corrected, we carry that with us, not recognizing what we're carrying. Right. I mean, you articulated so wonderfully about why that guy would have loved rap music, right. You know, and it was based on appearance of what he was wearing. Right. We move so quickly. I think it's a natural thing where we have to make decisions very quickly to move through our world. And if we're not mindful about why we're doing those kinds of things, we kind of end up in positions where even though we may not want it, we might be engaging in sometimes racist or discriminatory behavior. And that's what this book is about, right? Is going back to understanding who we are and why we think the way that we do, what's contributed to that, and how it starts to impact the thinking of people who are from different cultures that are not from the dominant white culture.
I think it's interesting too, your perspective, being born and raised in Winnipeg, right? And to you, you're saying that's my culture. I was born in Winnipeg. I live in Winnipeg. That's where I'm from. That's, you know, but feeling as though, and this is something you articulated in your TED talk, which I think, I presume is going to be in the book as well, which is that people asking you, no, really, where are you from? Means that you're sort of an outsider in your own culture. And now you don't really have a place at all. Right. And that's sort of the issue that people in your situation are coming up against all the time.
So actually, I wasn't born in Winnipeg. I immigrated here when I was a kid. But I mean, it makes a point perfectly because, I mean, I've lived here for all of my life, for most of my life. But having, you know, when I go back to do, I've done a lot of work in Tanzania and in Zanzibar. And going back, like, I remember, like, people calling me Mzungu, which in Swahili means a white person. You know, right. And that wasn't based on my skin color. That was based on my behavior. And how culture and how we present ourselves is, I mean, it makes two points. How our culture and our ethnicity is not just about how we appear, but the values that we hold and how we engage and how we behave with people, but also that I wasn't at home there too.
Right.
And there's so many of us that we're not made to feel at home. That you're a perpetual foreigner, and that's actually an interesting bias that we found in our bias test as well too. That people of color tend to be perpetually seen as foreigners, and xenophobia is rampant. Even when people are well meaning, I mean, that whole question about but where are you from suggests that you are an outsider, because if you're a person of color, you couldn't be local.
And I wonder too. You mentioned right earlier that the way we've looked at sort of cultural competency over the years is from an international perspective, right? The culture over there, how do we understand that culture? And then we try to apply that to the people that we meet here. How has that informed your work? You've gone and worked in Tanzania and you come back here, and how has that changed the way that you look at this sort of thing?
I mean, I think what it does is it provides me a vantage point or several vantage points that other people may not necessarily have, you know, and the interesting thing is the place that I was born and the culture that I was raised in both when I was born and I was a child in Tanzania, but also as a subculture here in Canada is a culture that's actually quite mixed. And so I see this vantage point, not only as an immigrant, not as a Canadian, not only as a Muslim, but also somebody who's got an intersecting cultural identity. And I like that. And I think for the longest time, I tried to put that side of me away, you know, because it wasn't professional, so to speak.
Right.
But I recognize, yeah. But I recognize now that it wasn't, although I value my education as a psychologist and my experience as a psychologist, and I think that certainly the framework that allows me to look at things. But I think the heart and soul of my work is my lived experience. You know, the thing that wouldn't have been professional is the thing that I think informed me the most. And the lived experience of my family, the lived experience of my community members, the lived experience of my friends, that I can take those things and now put them in a context, a language that's psychological to help people understand. And I think it really speaks to the value of that lived experience of marginalized people that often is discredited. Right. And that's kind of what I want to do with this book, is like, let me bring back the lived experience. And in the book, actually, I use a lot of examples of people that I know, of clients that I've worked with, and even in some cases, my own personal experiences, because I think it's very valuable to demonstrate the impact of not being anti-racist and culturally competent on people and their lived experiences if we're ignoring them.
Does Winnipeg factor into this in any way, right? And this may entirely be a cultural bias on my part. I lived in Winnipeg for a little while, and I worked in radio for years before I started here at the CPA. And I remember hearing some of the radio broadcasts that were coming out of Winnipeg and thinking, oh my God, I can't believe people are not being censored for saying these terribly racist things on the air, right? I mean, that really was shocking to hear the radio broadcasts out of Winnipeg. And it gave me the sense that that's one of the large cities in Canada that really doesn't embrace multiculturalism the way other cities do. I mean, even more so, right? That there's a more overt underpinning, I guess, of racism running through the culture of Winnipeg. Am I wrong in that?
You're 150% right. I mean, it's the irony is that we've got a license plate that says Friendly Manitoba. And at the same time, we were also dubbed the most racist city in Canada, you know, by Maclean's magazine. So you are 150% correct. I can speak to, I mean, I think as Canadians and as Winnipeggers and Manitobans, we often look down our noses at Americans thinking, you know, that they're often a lot more racist. And I can tell you from firsthand experience from my work in the States that actually I find many Americans to be far more educated and informed and culturally sensitive than I would a lot of Canadians, and that includes Winnipeggers as well too. That lived experience of living here, but also I remember when that McLean's article came out, I mean, I wanted to make it a goal that Winnipeg become the heart and soul of change, not just for Winnipeg, but for Canada. You know, that the place that was dubbed the most racist city in Canada becomes the place of change where we start to model, I think, not just for ourselves, but also for the rest of the country, how to become more inclusive. And so I've engaged in certain projects and public advocacy campaigns that have moved towards cultural inclusion. The irony is that, you know, many of the leaders in the city, including both previous and current mayors, really have approached this, you know, from a rather narcissistic and selfish point of view. And I'm very open about that. Yeah. You know, I'm very open about that. And I think that's the challenge, right? Is how do you get leaders who have not experienced marginalization and racism to work on a problem that impacts at least a third of the city?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I would say not just a third of the city, because I think racism and discrimination and lack of inclusion impacts non-racialized people as well too. At least a third of the city. How do you take that seriously? And so I think there's been change, which I'm really happy to see. I mean, the work that I've done has helped a lot of school systems. And I think there's a lot of schools and school divisions now have moved towards adopting this concept of celebrating everything, which I can talk about in a bit. We've got local businesses. We've got the Chamber of Commerce here. I mean, so we see people recognizing the problem and now adopting a lot of the recommendations that myself and our team had made, which is very nice. But the places that need it the most are the places that usually reject it the most. And unfortunately, that's a lot of our political leaders.
Yeah, I do want to talk about the school system and the way that's working right now, because I'm imagining you've got this, it's not that new anymore, but it was new when I went and visited it a few years ago, the Human Rights Museum in Winnipeg. Mm-hmm. This massive national project, I assume that kids now in school get to go there on field trips and, you know, take in all of this sort of cultural knowledge from a place like that. Is that part of what the school system is doing now? And is that maybe one of the reasons they're moving toward a more inclusive framework?
Canadian Museum of Human Rights has actually done some really wonderful things about working to educate and inform, I think, not just Winnipeggers, but Canada. But I also think that it's had its history and its current problems with some very serious issues of a lack of inclusion, open discrimination as well, too. I mean, and that would range from, you know, a complete initial refusal to note the human rights complaints of Palestinians, of Indigenous peoples, and most recently, even, you know, the LGBT and queer community as well, too. So it's got its issues as well, too. I think the dilemma, and where I come at it from a psychologist, is that we really have to have grassroots movements that work like public health initiatives. For me, that's where we need to begin. And I do believe concepts of racism and discrimination are a public health issue because it's tied to our psychology and how we look at things. And it does impact the mental health of our society overall.
There's a lot of research showing it impacts mental health in a huge way. Yeah.
So this is a public health initiative, which means we can't really approach it from this like la-di-da ivory tower approach, which is how it's been done. We need to work on integration of not just education, but a shift in practice. I'd like to tell you about our Win Love campaign, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Really spots.
Yeah, and so our clinical team here developed Win Love or Winnipeg Love, WINNLOVE.ca. And that's free license. So any city, any psychologist out there who gets on this website can take those. They're basically tips based on positive psychology that help improve civic pride where people take ownership. So instead of having a passive approach to civic pride, they take an active approach of things they can do to improve their communities and feel better about where they live. And one of those tips, or at least a couple of those tips, are tied to inclusion. One of them was what we call celebrate everything. And this idea that, you know, when I talk about white supremacy, and I particularly mean a cultural white supremacy, if we look at the holidays that we celebrate in Canada, how much of that really reflects the diversity of our community? And it doesn't. They reflect a white-centered Euro-Christian-based holiday system. You know, we don't see Rosh Hashanah. We don't see Yom Kippur. We don't see Diwali. We don't see Eid or Ramadan. We don't see Lunar New Year. We don't even see, we are just getting to the point where, you know, we have one day a year acknowledged to acknowledging the harms done to Indigenous people. But even our National Indigenous Peoples Day, which should be the primary holiday, is not a national holiday. And so, you know, my movement is to say that these are holidays. We add 8 additional holidays to our current calendar that would really be inclusive of all Canadians. And if we did that, that's what, you know, we would be not just educating people about what those days are, but we'd be including people. It would change our economy because people would be purchasing more. And we approach things now from a more celebratory perspective. And so there's a lot of communities that have already done this. Like I said, a lot of school systems have now moved towards this, although they can't have the days off. They are moving to celebrating those days in the same level that they would Christmas, which is good. We see a lot of businesses now working to include that. We've had some very large companies that I've consulted with have moved to have their companies now have that done. Our city is now allowing people to choose what days they take off, which is good, but is refusing. I mean, this is one of the frustrating things, refuses to recommend additional days off to the province. So, but we are seeing change. And I think that's the kind of public health campaign that we need to approach this as, to help change not just the way people think, but also the way they behave. And ultimately that changes how we feel about each other.
I really like that idea. I like that concept a lot. I think a lot in the summer months, especially around Canada Day, right? Canada Day is a huge celebration, especially here in Ottawa. It's massive, right? And there's a lot of people who have been protesting against it over the last few years, right? Canada obviously has a shameful history of its treatment of Indigenous people and, you know, others as well. And they want to not celebrate Canada because of this. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think what you're saying is, but why can't we do both? We can celebrate being Canadian, but we can also celebrate Indigenous culture. We can also celebrate Muslim culture with Ramadan. We can also celebrate Jewish culture with Yom Kippur, right? We can celebrate all these things without having to detract from any of them.
We should be moving towards a celebration of everything. I think where we've gone right now is that, you know, a fear of offending people has moved us to sterilizing culture. You know, where we remove, I don't think we've really removed Christmas, but I think people think that they've removed Christmas, you know, by saying happy holidays. I don't think that's what's happened, but I do think it's time. And I use a very controversial phrase, this concept of defunding Christmas. And it's not about the removal of Christmas, but about taking the resources we put into one group of people, one holiday, and forcing everybody to, you know, to adopt that value system or those holidays, and now spread that around over the course of the year, where we all feel included, you know, in the same way. And it's important, and I talk about this in the book as well too. This cultural sensitivity and understanding is really a one-way street. You see, I don't celebrate Christmas, but I could tell you every nuanced element about Christmas.
Right, of course, know? Yeah.
Because I'm Canadian.
Yeah.
And my friends and neighbors celebrate Christmas. Some of the closest people to me celebrate Christmas. But those people could not tell you an ounce of information about what it means to be a Muslim Canadian. And so we have this one-way street where there's not that equality, where people of color, people from cultural communities, people from marginalized communities, they get the larger piece. They get what it's like to be, you know, for many people, a white Canadian. Mm-hmm. Or a European or a Christian Canadian, but doesn't go the other way. And it really needs to begin to go the other way on multiple fronts. In the same way that I can honor Christmas and take that day off, I think people should be honoring a lot of other holidays too. And I think people would appreciate those communities too if they got a day off for that holiday, you know. And I do think it's time. I think Canada's come to a time in history where we have to come to a reckoning of what it means to be Canadian. And certainly there's a debate of whether we should be celebrating Canada Day or not. But I certainly think, I mean, this is the idea of the president of the Chamber of Commerce. He's like, maybe we should just be removing Victoria Day altogether and putting in some of these other holidays. You know, it's time that we move towards this anti-colonial perspective where we start to celebrate communities and Canada for who it really is versus for who we are told we should be.
Are you doing that now? I mean, are you holding celebrations? Are you attending celebrations? Do these things exist and just need to be scaled up, or do they need to be created? Is there a big celebration, for example, of Rosh Hashanah in Winnipeg that people can attend and learn about, or do we need to scale that up in a bigger way so that people can participate?
We do need to scale it up in a bigger way so people recognize. And the thing about many marginalized communities and people of color or marginalized cultural communities is that, you know, we face such great amounts of racism and discrimination that often we just go along with what's easier. It's too threatening for us to be able to step forward. And this is where we turn to leaders, including particularly political leaders, to be able to make the change because they have the power to be able to do so. Now, psychologists have been working on advocacy on psychological services and healthcare. And like, don't get me wrong, I think that's all very valuable and that needs to happen. But we are so behind that, I mean, we can't catch up. We need to be thinking about public health measures that improve the health and well-being of society and ultimately mental illness as well, too. And so I think this is where politicians and those leaders need to start to be thinking outside of the box and taking advice from psychologists that guide them into behaviors or at least systems that would help promote more positive mental health in society. And that would include taking the reins on not relying on, I mean, you think marginalized communities have the ability to scale up? Are you kidding? We get swatted back down.
Right.
I mean, even if you take the example of Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah versus Hanukkah, Hanukkah is not a high holiday in the Jewish community. But because of all this anti-Semitism and all the difficulties, you know, many families, Jewish families, will go along with Hanukkah because, you know what, it's more, it goes along with the same timeline as Christmas.
Right.
And so the main holiday, which is a value to the Jewish community, it's not really getting acknowledged. People schedule holidays or meetings at the same time, you know, as high holidays. I mean, how insensitive is that? You know,
yeah.
These, it's time. It's time. I mean, that book is for practitioners, but those, not just practitioners, but anybody for, but it's time those individuals take those values and apply them to their leadership roles and saying, okay, we've got it. We got to do some, we got some shit to change here.
You mentioned earlier, and I'm sort of thinking that this is along the same lines, right? You mentioned the fear that people have of engaging with a culture with which they're not familiar, right? And maybe I'm going to say the wrong thing. I'm worried about that. I'm going to just try to not participate so that I don't, you know, offend somebody, so I don't make the wrong move. But at the same time, right, and you're mentioning, right, Hanukkah, not a high holiday, not a huge thing in the Jewish faith, but it coincides with Christmas. And so the rest of us will say, oh, yes, Christmas and Hanukkah, we'll check the box, and Kwanzaa, also Kwanzaa, just created around that time so that there could be a celebration, right? Like, I think that's, it's a 50-year-old celebration. I don't think it existed before the 1960s, right? So it's been created so that there's something for somebody else during that particular holiday season, but also not a major holiday, but we check that box also. And we say Kwanzaa, we say Hanukkah, right? And I think in a way that's trying to articulate it well, and I'm not having an easy time of it, but I do think that it's sort of from that same fear-based thing. Well, we've checked the box, we're good, but I don't want to delve any deeper into it for fear of offending anybody or, you know.
Well, it's not just centering holidays around Christmas is, and I would say any other practices around white culture, is not just about fear. I think that's about laziness. And I think it is about white supremacy that centers whiteness, that even when we are going to move towards inclusion, we're going to do it around the things that are already centered around whiteness. It's like, well, how offensive and horrible is that? I think we have the opportunity now as a community, as a country, with greater, I don't think we're fully aware, but I think with greater awareness about mental health and well-being, that it's time we start to review what needs to be done. These aren't changes that are that complex. You know,
no.
I mean, in the blink of an eye, we all had a day off when, you know, Queen Elizabeth passed away. And yet the Indigenous community has been advocating for National Indigenous Peoples Day off forever. And in a blink of an eye, you know, the head of the colonial power dies and we get all the day off. But Indigenous people here are fighting to get that day off because of all the harms done to them and recognizing them as our first people. And that's not happening. So I think there's a sense of laziness. I think there's a sense of complacency. And that's where I get at with this book, is that we can't be complacent. There's a great danger in the complacency of keeping things the way they are. Now, mind you, I think hypervigilance is also problematic. But we do have to move towards a mindful approach towards inclusion, where we're working on better incorporating the peoples in our community in the representation of our systems and the way that we engage in life. We need to redefine what our community actually is. And as it stands right now, our practice proves that we believe that our community is white, must act white. And if you don't do that, you are relegated to the back and you aren't allowed. You're treated as some sort of fanatic.
And also this idea, if you want to center your culture on a holiday of some kind, if you want to, you know, bring some sort of, I don't know, something into the office that centers your culture that you're trying to make us adapt to you. And therefore, yes, right, you've come to my country and you're telling me how to act. And there's this weird defensiveness that I've never quite understood on that. I mean, yeah, does it really affect you? I'm going to say it doesn't 99% of the time. And it's so much smaller than what people seem to make it out to be. But
yes, oh, fully agree with you. It's time we look beyond ourselves and not really approach our engagement with the Canadian community from an ego-centric or a culture-centric approach, which is how we do things now.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's in the practice of psychology or, you know, the governance of legal bodies or even just our entire country, you know, and anything outside of that is really performative and patronizing and insulting. And people don't recognize that not being authentic in our inclusion is just chronic creating, is just creating greater divide.
It seems to me, it seems like a really easy political lift to tell everybody that they're getting 8 more days off a year. Right? That seems like, you know, that seems to me, if I were a politician, I would love that. I would embrace that. I'd run with that. You get more days off work every year, all of you. Isn't that wonderful? Right? And yeah, then all of the stuff, you know, moving the money around and celebrating all of those things comes with it. And I think that sounds like a great idea. I have a hard time understanding why people aren't embracing that right now.
Yeah, racism. That's basically it. And remember, that racism is always just a conscious element of that. It's just to give up that power is a hard thing for people. Like I said, I've met with recently the mayor of our city, who went on record with me around other people in a meeting, who said, "I'm going to make this clear. We, as a mayoral office, will not make the recommendation to the province that we should be having these additional days off." Why? No answer why, no nothing to that. Fully aware of the impact that what he was saying was actually promoting a great sense of systemic racism, didn't want to change. But I think that when people have privilege, they don't want to lose it. I think people are afraid of change, you know, and I think it's lazy, frankly speaking, incredibly lazy, to recognize that, you know, if you're not going to use your leadership to positively impact the well-being of other people, and frankly, I would say the economy as well, too, because that's when people are spending more, right? That is a seriously lazy and harmful thing to do.
We have less than 1 minute left here, so I have one final question for you. This is, again, from your TED Talk. Your TED Talk was about 5 years ago, and you referenced your young son being able to see Black Panther and finding something. He believed at that time that the Black Panther was Muslim, and you didn't want to disabuse him of the notion at the time. Does he now know 5 years later that Black Panther was not, in fact, Muslim?
He does know, but he's still really proud to have a person of color in that leadership superhero role. But since then, has seen some other leaders as well, too, including Kamala Khan, you know, Miss Marvel.
Yes.
You know, and even the new Spider-Man, who he's just a big fan of, right? So, Miles Morales.
Representation is important, and we're getting there slowly. But as Dr. Abdul-Rahman says, representation doesn't matter if we're not truly embracing the differences that representation seeks to highlight. His work is helping to move us toward that goal, starting with this new book, Developing Anti-Racist Cultural Competence, available now through the link in the show notes. My thanks to Dr. Abdul-Rahman for joining me today on Mindful, and to you at home for streaming, downloading, and listening on your chosen podcast platform. Mindful is written, hosted, and published by me, Eric Bowman. Our producer is Jamie Montgomery, and our theme music is Avenues by David Taylor.